Hey folks, it's Mike Maxwell here, and welcome to the first episode of The Outlander, a new podcast of mine where I wander around the Australian wilderness and basically give you my takes, my thoughts on anything that's kind of on my mind. I'll share some stories, some anecdotes, some experiences, some personal wisdom and things like that. And hopefully it'll be good. Hopefully you'll enjoy it. Hopefully you'll get something out of it. So let's go take a walk around. All right, folks, I had to relocate here, so hopefully the lighting situation isn't too bad. As you can see, it's a little bit overcast. I'm filming right now in the winter here in Australia, such as it is, the winter. But I've been thinking about doing this podcast for a long time, wanting to do it. In planning for it, thinking what's the first episode going to be about? What's the great inauguration? What's the first thing that I wanted to discuss? And I figured I would just start by getting started, which is, I think, actually more in keeping with our sort of ancestral ways. Our ancestors were not big on gigantic systems and building all that kind of stuff. They were practical people. So what I wanted to talk about here is the topic that's been on my mind kind of recently, which is that the power of narrative and the power of storytelling. And as many of you guys know, my co-host on Culture Dads, Dave Martell, is one of the best storytellers around. He knows how to do it. He has it. I'm not quite as good as he is, but I can do it here and there, sort of thing. But it is very important. Stories are obviously very important to our folk. And they're important for a reason. They're important to every people for a good reason. Number one, they communicate imperatives. And we'll get to that. But I guess probably the best way for me to put this across is to give you guys an example. So my daughter, she's pretty young, but she has been into environmentalism for a little while now. She's really getting, when she walks down the street, she'll find a piece of trash in the ground and she'll just pick it up and bring it into the car, much to Dad's annoyance. But it's good. It's coming from a really good place. And what she says to me is that, look, Dad, if I don't pick it up, and I think that someone else is just going to pick it up, and then that somebody else thinks the same thing, they think that somebody else is going to pick it up, and then they think someone else is going to pick it up, and so on, well, nobody's going to pick it up. What do you think, Dad? Do you think that's right? And, of course, I told her, I do think that's right, sweetheart. I think you're exactly right. But beyond that, I think there's a better way to reinforce it. So what I did was I told her a little story. And I'm going to share it with you guys, this story. Because I think this idea that if you don't deal with it, nobody will, applies to a lot more than just the environment. So, where should I start? When the missus and I decided to move to Australia, one of the things that was really driving that decision, it was kind of a number of things that sort of added up to move us away from Canada. But we lived in a city where, let's just say this, it regularly makes the top five least livable cities in the world annually in terms of cost of living. So we knew we had to leave because we just couldn't afford it. I mean, we just knew we were getting to a point, getting a bit older, where we wanted to get a house. We wanted to own a home of our own. Nice background noise, eh, here in the Australian outback. Anyway, we decided we were gonna own a home of our own, and we were just never ever gonna be able to manage that in the city that we were living in. So we decided to leave. But the place we were living was not the only city that we lived in Canada. We lived in a few other different cities. So we thought, well, are we gonna move somewhere else? You know, we haven't been to Alberta. Maybe we could go to Alberta. And for reasons that are actually hard to remember at this moment, we decided that we would just go on an adventure and go to someplace completely wild, someplace completely different. So without going into the details, we decided to leave Canada and go to Australia. An opportunity came up that would allow us to immigrate, so we did just that. And when we got here, it took us a while to financially get on our feet and, you know, to sort of reestablish our careers and everything like that. So it took a few years to get that together. And we were already getting on in years, you know. We weren't like, you know, 20 or something when we left. We were much older than that. So it took us a while. It took us a while before we were ready to buy our own home. And we did that eventually. At some stage, it felt like it took forever. But we did get to where we could afford it. And we did buy our own home. And any of you guys, anybody who has either had children late in life or has worked really hard to get the career that they want and finally got it, or, you know, anybody who has otherwise suffered and struggled to get something and finally, after all that work, got the thing, you know how much you cherish that thing. I'm not saying that, like, you know, young parents don't love their kids. Obviously they do. I'm just saying that if you had to work for it and maybe consider the possibility that you might never get it, when you do get it, it's pretty special. And this is the way it was for us when we got our first house, our only house. So we moved into this thing. It's in a suburb that I knew we wanted to live here. It's beautiful. The city council has done a lot of work beautifying it and making it look amazing. I knew we wanted to live here. It was just, I mean, it's not like we don't have tons of money or anything. We just lived where we could and the most beautiful spot. But for me, it was like a little slice of paradise. I absolutely love where we live. And we'd worked so hard for so long to get it. And when we got here, I decided that I was going to do things right. That is, you know, I wasn't going to be the guy who just like moves into a neighborhood, never talks to anybody. I wanted to get to know my neighbors. I wanted to be like part of the community, get involved and like befriend people and everything like that. So that's exactly what I did. I got to know a bunch of the people that I lived around, and these are very nice folks. A lot of them are good friends, but not everybody. Not everybody. There was one chap who lived a couple of doors down from me, who I did not get along with at all. He was not a very nice fellow. So this gentleman, this fellow who lived a couple of doors down from me, was kind of a weird cat. you know, we've all known somebody like this. He was really, he's like really into his toys, into his car, into like, you know, I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. Like, you know, I'm not casting shade on anybody who's like a car person, but like, he was just kind of a weird person, a weird guy that was like, he kind of kept to himself a little bit, but like wasn't really friends with like a lot of the other neighbors. And he was just kind of a weird guy, to be honest. But that wasn't the problem. I mean, whatever. But the problem was this, is that he seemed to have a friend circle that was pretty big, and he would invite them all over at some stage, like, you know, from time to time, you know, whatever. I don't know what they'd be doing. They'd have a barbecue or something. And all his friends would turn the Verge across the street into their own personal parking lot. And now, the reason why I went on for some length a couple of minutes ago about how beautiful the suburb is that I lived in, especially for somebody like me that's not super rich, that can afford it, this was a big deal, because when I first moved into this suburb, it was very well maintained by the council. And as time went on, as they sold properties, as you know, people, as they basically no longer needed to continue to beautify it, to raise the property values enough to profit, the council basically stopped maintaining these places, at least somewhat. They don't maintain them like they used to. And I live on a street where across the way is a Verge that has some landscaping on it. It's really, really nice looking. It's like, you know, this is one of the reasons why I wanted to live there. It's very picturesque and very beautiful. And I take pride in the place that I live. I want it to look nice. I don't want it to look like shit. And this gentleman would invite his friends over, take all of their big trucks, park it across the Verge, drive over the bushes, drive over all of the landscaping, drive over all the plants, and like knock down, they even knocked down little trees and stuff like that. It was absolutely appalling. And anyway, so, I mean, all the folks on my street, they all saw it. Everybody saw it. Everybody saw what was going on, and nobody was happy about it. But, you know, nobody decided to do anything about it. And me, not being from Australia in the first place, you know, when you come to a new country, you don't always know, like, you know, what the customs are. I mean, of course, Australia is not that different than Canada. It's not like moving to Mongolia or something. But you don't know, right? You're like, you know, it could very well be that it's just like culturally accepted that you park on people's lawns. Like in Canada, if you parked on someone's lawn, they might come out and like fight you. that's a transgression. Whereas in Australia, that seems to be something that's okay here. Like people do it. Whatever, I'm not used to it, but. So I thought to myself, well, maybe it's okay. Maybe it's like, you're allowed to do that here. So I called up the local council and I asked them, I said, is, you know, this guy's like parking like across the bushes. That doesn't seem right to me. Is it okay? Like, is he allowed to do that? And they're like, no, he's definitely not. What street are you on? So anyway, like I just asked him the question and gave them information, and then I forgot about it. His party ended, all the big throng went home, and that was, you know, the last I thought about it. And then, of course, you know, a week or two later, when the same fucking thing happens, and all his entourage pulls up, and there's like, you know, 30 cars stacked down the street as far as the eye can see, I went out there with my phone and I started taking pictures of their license plates, because I was like, I fucking had enough of this shit. And then he comes out. So this guy comes out with his friend and confronts me and says, what are you doing? Taking pictures of people's cars. I'm like, take a look over here, what you're doing. You're destroying the fucking Verge. Like, you know, my property taxes pay for this shit and I don't appreciate it very much. And it started to escalate from there and become a confrontation. And he said something to the effect of, You know, don't you have anything better to do than to like snoop into other people's business and et cetera, et cetera? I was like, yeah, yeah, I do have better things to do. And that's why it's so fucking annoying that I have to babysit a grown ass man and all his fucking friends. Anyway, I'm getting irritated about it right now. It was pretty dicey there. It could have gone in a very bad direction. But anyway, I managed to de-escalate the situation. There was no fight or anything like that, you know. I was getting ready to take off the old belt. Dad was getting ready to come out. Anyway. I de-escalated the situation. That was the end of it. And he just kept doing it as time went on. But every day I would go out there and see him. And I would just give him a little wave, a little, hey, how you going, mate? How you doing? How you going? As the Australians say, how you going, mate? Give him a little wave. And he'd give a little grumble, you know. He wasn't too happy about it, you know. He knew that I saw him, he saw me. I know that he's an asshole. He knows that I confronted him. It was a little bit embarrassing in front of his friend, and so on and so forth. And every day I'd go out and walk by. Some days he wouldn't be there, but most days I'd see him, give him a little wave, a little hello, little fuck you, little unspoken fuck you. And this just kept going on for weeks and weeks and months, until one day I saw, pulled into his driveway, a moving truck. And I thought to myself, ah, well, isn't that nice? That's great. I'm very happy to see this. Now, it would have been nice if it had happened months ago, before The Verge turned into a fucking desert, before he reduced it all to sand and destroyed everything. It would have been nice if it had happened before that, but at least something happened. At least he's going now. And now, I don't pretend to be think that I am the reason why he moved. I'm sure that there were many other reasons involved in the decision. But I do like to think that I created an environment of hostility and unneighborliness that contributed to this decision. You know, it may not have been me, but that was one factor playing into the whole thing. So that's where it laid, basically. And I told my daughter this story. I told her this story. And as I'm telling her this story, now she's a very emotional kid. She's emotionally sensitive, that's kind of the wrong word, but she's emotionally intelligent. She picks up on things very well. When she's watching TV, she'll sit there and she gets really into it. She'll jump around, she'll get excited, she'll like cry when something happened, you know, like she gets really involved in it. And I could see, as I was telling this story, I could see the wheels turning in that little head. I could see the emotional reaction, the sort of like, you know, thing going on when I explained to her about the confrontation and all of that. And I guess where I'm going with this is that if I had just said to her, if I had just kind of said, okay, sweetheart, yes, you're right. You should pick up that garbage, because if you don't, nobody else will. I could have said that, but it wouldn't have made nearly the impact of telling her the story about bullying this fucking asshole out of the neighborhood. Because if I didn't do something about that, nobody else would. Now, this is not some big heroic gesture or anything, you know. This isn't, whatever. Insert your heroic exploit. This is nothing of the sort. It's just a small thing, just a little thing that one person can do to make a little bit of a change in their world. And The power of narrative, the power of the story, is in driving that home much, much better than anything else ever could. And here's the thing about the narrative. Here's the thing about a story, as opposed to, say, a scientific theory or something like that. Stories tell you things that are true. Stories consist of propositions that have a truth value. Stories are a series of truth-apt statements. They are a series of facts, one after another. But they're more than that. They're more than just a series of facts. They are also, behind them lies something much, much deeper than a scientific theory, as I say, or, you know, a law, or whatever, any other series of utterances or series of propositions. The story is a series of commands or imperatives couched in the language of proposition. The story tells you what ought to be while telling you what is. It bridges the is-ought gap in that sense. What the story does fundamentally is it imparts values. It tells you what you should believe. It tells you what, not only what you should believe, it tells you what you should do. It carries with it a kind of normative force that other forms of propositional content, all other forms of discourse, they don't contain that. But the story does. And this is why narratives are so important. This is why they're the oldest things that we have. I mean, we might be able to reconstruct snippets of poetic formulae, you know, things like that, like kleos aftiton, which exists both in the Vedic literature and the Homeric literature. You know, we can recreate these little particles, but the oldest continuous extended literature that we have is in the form of stories. It's not dialogues, it's not philosophy, it's not anything like that. It is the story. And this is why the story is so important. And this is why it's important to try at least to cultivate the ability to tell the story. Now, I'm not as good as Dave is, but this is something that I have tried to do. And it's something that I encourage all of you to do. Because if you can tell a good story, people like you. If you can tell a good story, you're going to be well-liked at work. If you can tell a good story, if you can hold the room, hold people's attention, people are going to take you seriously, and they're going to say, that guy is a person that needs to be listened to. Let's hear what he's got to say. That is the power of narrative. So I think that that's important for us to understand.
At the corner of 36 and 9, looking out to see an unbroken succession of all green lights flashing on and on.
So I wanted to say that, basically. I just wanted to say why I thought that telling the story of, you know, my altercation with the neighbor was so much more edifying for my daughter than just saying, yep, you're right, or you're right because X, Y, Z. Now she'll remember it. But I wanted to go beyond that. I wanted to kind of talk about the lesson itself that's embedded in this story, which is, I think, kind of important. It's a very important thing to get. And that is that the world is the way it is, that is falling apart. The world is fucked because good men tolerate shitty behavior. The world is fucked because good men tolerate shitty behavior. Now that might seem obvious. It might seem obvious. And it might seem like the solution to it is equally obvious. And maybe it is. Maybe it is obvious. But it's the kind of thing that is easy to forget in the moment. It's easy to forget as you're going through life and distracted and things happen and there's uncertainty and all of that. It's easy to forget that. So it actually reminds me of, you guys might be familiar with this guy named Jocko Willink. I'm not that familiar with him. I've watched a couple of his videos, a couple of his interviews or whatever. He's not, I mean, he's a good motivational speaker. He's a good storyteller. He can hold the room. He can command people's attention. And for those of you who don't know who he is, I don't know what exactly, but he was a military man of some kind, a soldier, I believe in the Iraq War. In any case, an American soldier who has been known, who has come to prominence as a motivational speaker, basically. And he looks like he's a jarhead. He looks like this. He's got that look about him. You just look at him and you're like, okay, this guy's served some time in the military, right? He just looks like it. And so the reason why I bring up Jocko Willink is because I actually saw a talk that he gave. It was a TED talk. I don't know if you guys know what I have heard me rant about TED talks before, but I think TED talks are absolutely vacuous and retarded. And I rarely have ever seen anything good. It seems like the one weird tip. They're always very contrarian and like, you know, well, actually, now that science tells us that the opposite of what you think is true is true. It's like, it's just really like blunt and stupid contrarianism. Some of these TED Talks are okay, but I did see a TED Talk with Jocko Willink, and this was one of the best things I've ever seen. And what he did was he told the story of a firefight in, I think, the Iraq War, don't quote me, that went wrong, horribly wrong, where in the confusion and the fog of war and the crossfire and the insanity that most of us cannot even imagine of war, there was a friendly fire exchange, and a bunch of his men killed a bunch of his other men, or a bunch of his men killed some of their comrades. And the story that he told was really more about the debriefing that happened after this. It was about how he justified that to his superiors. Now, anybody that is involved in the military or knows anything about it knows that friendly fire is like the worst thing that can happen. The worst thing. Because it's you killing your own guys because somebody fucked up. And as the commander or the, you know, whoever, who, as the head of command in his little unit, the person that fucked up ultimately was him. He brought his guys in and had a little briefing with them before he debriefed his superiors. And they all of his men basically said, it was my fault. You know, I could have done this, but I didn't. And they all said the same thing, some variation on that. And he said, look, guys, no. It's not your fault. It's my fault. It's my fault. Because I'm the boss. The buck stops with me. I'm the one that has ultimate responsibility. So if anybody has fucked up, it's me. And this is exactly what he said to his superiors. When they came in, he debriefed them. I don't know how to say it. There was an exchange where he basically took radical ownership over the situation and said, everything that happened was my fault. I could have done this at this point. I didn't tell XYZ to do that. The chain of command broke down because of me and my failing here, there, and he pointed out all of the specifics. Thinking that what was going to happen is that he was going to be court-martialed, he was going to be punished, maybe he was going to face criminal charges, and he was a dead man, basically, right? But that's not what happened. That's not what happened. Instead, what happened was that his superiors, while recognizing his failures in the moment, while seeing that he had obviously made some mistakes, errors of judgment that were forced by the situation, despite all of that, they realized that this was a trustworthy individual, that he was never going to lie to them, that he would always give it to them straight. And this ultimately led to his, in fact, being promoted in his station, and so on and so forth. I won't go through the whole thing. Watch it. It's like 10 minutes long. He tells it in like twice the amount of time I just told it. It's very brief. But the point is, radical ownership is something that we need to understand. The radical ownership of good men. The world is in the shape it's in because good men tolerate poor behavior. And therefore, it is actually good men who are to blame for the shape that the world is in. It's not evil men that created this world. It's weak, good men. It's men who looked around and said, "That's wrong," and didn't do anything about it. It's men who, walking down the street, saw trash and didn't pick it up. It's men who saw somebody shitting all over something beautiful and just let it be, let it go on. There's that siren again. Speaking of, the world is fucked because of good men, not because of bad men. So I'd like you guys to think on that. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time. Whoa!